Hello, everyone. This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs coming to you again with our Halachic Man series. Sorry for the delay. Those of you that follow the news may have heard that we're under something of attack here in Israel. And at exactly 10 o'clock when I was about to start the class, the sirens went off and our whole family gathered together here in our safe room, which usually doubles as my study and my broadcast studio for Web Yeshiva. So things hopefully have calmed down for the evening. And but if you are following the news, this session is being recorded on the evening of Tuesday, July 8th, 2014. And if you're listening to this at some point in the distant future through the archives, you'll look back in the history books and find out that we went through a little tough spot here in Israel. But I hope that I hope that everything is okay now, wherever it is, or I should say whenever it is that you're listening to us. This series is brought to you in memory of Rabbi Ezra Labaton, Zichrono Livracha, sponsored by the Beta family. The three characters, halachic man, standing at the pinnacle, the Ish Halacha, cognitive man, the scientist, the Ish HaDa'at, and homo religiosus, the religious man, the conventional religious man, together have been the focus of our comparisons. We've said already countless times that homo religiosus feels this great tension between heaven and earth, and there's a dualism in his personality that creates a tremendous tension. Halachic man is not oblivious to this tension. He also lives with it, but yet he has found a way to transcend it, has found a way to resolve the tension. And this is the topic of chapter 11, the manner in which the halacha itself serves as the mediating verse, the mediating component to resolve that tension between heaven and earth, between being both a divine creature and a creaturely creature. And interestingly, the test case, the kind of litmus test that the Rav runs this comparison through is specifically that of Yom Kippur. This chapter is very much focused on the topic of Yom Kippur, and is really one of the Rav's most powerful statements about what Yom Kippur is as a day, as a mechanism for tshuva. This fundamental opposition between the ontological outlooks of homo religiosus and halachic man. Ontological in its essence, in its being, the very essential difference between the worldviews of homo religiosus and halachic man is reflected in the very being of these two personalities. It pervades their entire characters. The tendency towards subjectivity, and now he delineates some of the characteristics of each. The syntax of this paragraph is a little, it takes two reads, so I'll just summarize it. Homo religiosus is subjective. He desires the blurring of boundaries, the confusion of domains, the lower with the higher. We live down here in this world, but yet we aspire towards the transcendental realm, and we're trying to break down those barriers. We're trying to blur those barriers. We're trying to blur the barrier between the corporeal and the spiritual, between man as a physical body, as an animal creature, and man as possessing of a divine spark. The lower with the higher, the revealed with concealed. However, on the other hand, for halachic man, the thrust towards objectivity and lawfulness, toward a firmly established creation, well-formed, possessing boundaries, statutes, and judgments of halachic men, mold the images of the two godly individuals. They are both godly individuals, the homo religiosus, halavai, we should all be homo religiosus. Forget halachic men. That would be a great improvement in and of itself. But there are differences. One strives for subjectivity. One strives for objectivity. One strives for a blurring of boundaries. The other seeks clear delineations. Homo religiosus is indeed highly subjective. He's different from scientific man. He's different from cognitive man. The scientist is distinguished by objectivity. I mean, after all, we know that that is the hallmark of science. That is the hallmark of academia. That is the hallmark of research, objectivity. And in this way, homo religiosus, religious man, is quite different. His psychic equilibrium and an almost eerie indifference. When cognitive man approaches the world, he takes great care that he not be disqualified as an interested party. He's not concerned in advance with the results of his cognition and study. He is but a watchman, a scout, a scribe, recorder, enumerator, sofer, mabit, kotev, sofer, monet, taken slightly out of context, a line from the Unatana Tokef on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Interestingly, the editor here the translator here has added in that these are terms from the Musaf prayer of Rosh Hashanah, but they're also from Yom Kippur, and presumably the association here is more with Yom Kippur, because that is the theme of the focus of the chapter. However, this is not the case with homo religiosus. When he stands before the cosmos, he's entirely aflame with the holy fire of wonder. He is all a shudder, confronted with the incomprehensible and unknown. Now, there is some repetition here with earlier chapters. There is some backtracking over ground which was trod earlier. His soul rages in storms like a tempestuous sea. He is frightened, terrified. Oh, did I say, I'm sorry, I think I may have misspoken. I think I may have said halakhic manner where I meant homo religiosus. As opposed to the scientist who seeks objectivity, simply recording data. As opposed to the scientist, homo religiosus is aflame with the holy fire of wonder, all a shudder, confronted with the incomprehensible and unknown. His soul rages in storms like a tempestuous sea. He is frightened, terrified by the mystery. He hides his face, for he is afraid to look upon it. He flees from it, but at the same time, against his will, willy-nilly, he draws near to it, enchanted, finds himself irresistibly pulled toward it, pines for it, and longs to merge with it. Homo religiosus is suspended between two giant magnets, between love and fear, between desire and dread, between longing and anxiety, these kinds of dyads that he's swinging in the balance between these opposing forces. He's caught between two opposing forces. The right hand of existence embraces him. The left thrusts him aside. Indeed, there is a great deal of truth in the view of Rudolf Otto, that fascination and repulsion constitute the two fundamental experiences of homo religiosus. He's making reference to, we've mentioned before, where is he? There he is, Rudolf Otto. Rudolf Otto was an early 20th century German philosopher of religion. He was most famous for a 1917 book called The Idea of the Holy, in which he develops this notion of the numinous, the great overpowering experience, the fearful and fascinating mystery of what the religious encounter is. We're drawn towards God, we're drawn towards the idea of the holy, but yet we're petrified of it because we know that it has this overwhelming power, the kind of respect that you have to show to great power, to knowing that you're overwhelmed. If anybody's ever been, we who, even the most faithful amongst us, experience religious moments often in a different way than they did centuries ago. But Lahavdil, even for the even for the most secular in the modern world, the atheistic even, if anybody's ever been present at some kind of natural disaster, tornado, hurricane, Hurricane Sandy, or what was that last big hurricane that you had on the East Coast in America? Was that Sandy? Yeah, that was Sandy. So all those videos that you had of people like standing there, like, you know, in Long Island or in other places, you know, like watching these waves rolling in and carrying away homes and cars and etc. You're fascinated. It's you can't turn your gaze away, but at the same time, it's of course you stand in awe at the power of nature that's being exhibited in front of you. So you have this fascination. You're drawn to it. You can't look away, but at the same time, you're petrified. Part of you wants to hide your face. Part of you wants to run away, and part of you is just completely, you know, multiply that by some factor of infinity to the God experience. It's this tension back and forth. So the Rav admits that this is the truth of Otto's claim, and that is a true description of homo religiosus. As a result, Avram, what is that? That's a link to the text. Avram, your mic is open. What were you saying? You put up a link to the German, the original. So Bina Chana can help us with the original German. But Avram presumably also read German. But for the rest of us, you'll have to get the English. As a result of fluttering to and fro between these powerful opposing poles, homo religiosus suffers from psychic torments and spiritual anguish. He undergoes terrible pains in the search for the enigma that will only darken reality even more. But it's a kind of, you know, going down the rabbit hole. In other words, the more you're drawn to it, the more you understand that it is unachievable. But at the same time, he delights in those very pains. And that knowledge that it's like one of those special effects that you see in Hollywood that, like as you're running towards, you're like running, I'm trying to picture, I'm sure I'm sure we could think of some, you know, scene from a movie where they use this effect. You're like running down a hall to get to a door at the end of the hall, but as you're running towards it, the door is receding into the distance. Like you're running towards it, but it's what? My son tells me this is the Matrix. It happens in the movie. I'm unaware of these things. So that same thing, that the more you're drawn to God, the deeper you understand how profoundly divided you are from Him. The more you understand how little you understand. The more you comprehend, the more you understand how beyond our comprehension He is. The closer you are, the more profoundly you feel the infinite divide that separates us. And that is a source of pain and anguish. And that pain is at the center of the experience of homo religiosus. The pain is not completely the notion of Yisurin Shel Ahava, of suffering for love, Chaviven Olah Yisurin, that we even embrace that kind of anguish. Is something that the homo religiosus is endemic to his experience. I can't. What does it say? The news is reporting that there was a house in Jerusalem that was hit by a missile. Thankfully, it seems that no one was hurt. I'm sure you can update on the internet. It is in this light, I'm skipping ahead, it is in this light that we can understand deep contradiction pervading the spiritual self-evaluation of homozygosis. On the one hand, he senses his own lowliness and insignificance, his own frailty and weakness. He knows that even a gnat preceded him, even a snail preceded him. These are words from the Medrash Rabbah, that on one hand, we know that we're nothing, we're garnished, that in the scheme of creation, even the bugs came first. Like God took care and attention to creating the bugs before he got around to us. On one hand, we're nothing. He sees himself as the one biological. In some cases, we're worse than that. In some cases, we're worse than the flea, because we are the one biological creature who has misused his own talents for destructive ends, who has failed in the task assigned to him. That's endemic to human nature, that we sin, that we fail, that we don't meet our potential. That's not true about animals. The anthropomorphic impulse that we have, you know, you watch little kids playing with animals. The Tyrannosaurus Rex is the bad dinosaur because he eats the other dinosaurs. But the Brontosaurus, as we used to call him, he's good because he just eats plants. He's nice. You could keep him if you're Fred Flintstone, you could keep him as a pet. That's ridiculous. The Tyrannosaurus Rex is not evil because he's a carnivore. That's the way he was created, right? It's completely anthropomorphic to assign value judgments, to sit there watching the National Geographic and think that, you know, the gazelle is good and the cheetah is bad because he eats the gazelle. They're doing what they're supposed to be doing. Cheetah's got to eat and gazelle's got to run. But sometimes the cheetah catches the gazelle, probably just enough so that he gets his meal. But there are probably just enough gazelles so that we still have gazelles. But there's no moral equation here. There's no, the whole idea that the animals that we don't eat, the animals that Kashrut forbids, are because those animals are evil, those animals have negative traits, because they're torfim, because they're animals of prey, so we don't eat them and we just eat the cows that hang around waiting for the wolves to come to eat them. That's purely speculative in the realm of Ta'amei HaMitzvot. It also, by the way, kind of puts us on the side of the wolf, not the cow. But in some way, humanity really is at the bottom of the rung, because as opposed to the animals who are just doing what it is that they're designed for by creation, we, exercising a kind of free will that animals don't have, we often get it wrong. We often get it wrong. We often miss our potential. On the other hand, he is aware of his own greatness. On the other hand, man is aware of his own greatness and loftiness, how his spirit breaks through all barriers and ascends to the very heights, bores through all obstacles, and descends to the very depths. He's not the crown of creation to whom God granted dominion. Is he, rhetorical question, is he not the crown of creation to whom God granted dominion over all the works of his hands? And God blessed them, and God said to them, Pru, Revu, Umalua Ta'aretz, V'kiv Shuha, subdue the earth, have dominion over the fish of the sea and the fowl of the heaven, over the beasts, over all the earth. The task that's given to Adam HaRishon. Now this pasuk is, those of you that are familiar with the teachings of Rabbi Soloveitchik, this should remind you of something. What is this pasuk the motto of, or for whom is this pasuk the motto? Those of you that studied the Lonely Man of Faith with us, this is the motto of Adam the First. You remember that Lonely Man of Faith, the Isha Emunah of Rabbi Soloveitchik, points out that the tale of creation is told twice. Genesis chapter 1, Genesis chapter 2. And the story of the creation of man, humanity, is told in different ways. And the Rav develops this idea that the two different angles that each chapter takes says something about the human personnel. And he develops these two archetypical characters, like he develops the archetypes here of halachic man and cognitive man and religious man. There, they're called Adam the First, the tale of creation as depicted in the first chapter of Genesis, and Adam the Second. Adam the First is majestic man. Adam the First is the one that's tasked with v'kivshuha, to stand at the pinnacle of creation, to dominate the created world. That's the majestic man, as opposed to Adam the Second. There's another parallel essay called Majesty and Humility, which we once studied together, and you can find those talks in the archives as well. It's the same idea. There's, on one hand, we're majestic. On the other hand, we're humble. So this dualism is built into creation because, in fact, there is no Adam the First and there is no Adam the Second. They are both components of each and every one of us. This is the blessing that God bestowed upon man. The antinomy is an integral part of man's creature consciousness. More, it is the source of the entire dispute concerning man's place within the cosmos. I'll skip ahead. Between the two poles of self-negation and absolute pride, man fluctuates between this dualism of self-negation and of pride, between a consciousness of nothingness and a consciousness of the infinity deep within him. Homo religiosus can never be free of this oscillation. Homo religiosus feels this pain, like a pendulum swinging between these two forces. In the depths of his consciousness, he is entangled in the thicket of two contradictory forces. This idea of shnei ketuvim hamachishim et zeh et zeh, two different poles, two different values, two different orientations that are pulling away at him. The Chazal talk about this idea of sometimes there are contradictory verses in the Torah that have to be resolved, that the tension can't be maintained. But for Homo religiosus, the tension is built in. It is unresolvable. One verse declares, "When I behold the heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast established, what is man? Ma enosh ki tizkerenu. What is man that thou, God, art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou thinkest of him?" Man is nothing. Ma enosh. What is he? He's a nothing. Like, why should you, God, even be concerned with man? However, the other verse declares, "Yet thou hast made him but a little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with the glory and honor. Thou hast made him to have dominion over the work of thy hand. Thou hast put all things under his feet." But there's something interesting in this pasuk from the 8th chapter of Tehillim. "B'techasrehu ma'at me'elokim." "B'techasrehu ma'at me'elokim." There are two ways to read the pasuk. That you have made him, that you, God, have created man to be but a little less than God himself, that we are almost godlike, or the way Chazal seemed to prefer interpreting Pasuk Elohim here, not in the technical sense of a name for God, but in the general sense Elohim, which, you know, has other as a synonym means other things. Sometimes Elohim means judges. Sometimes it can also apparently mean angels, and that's the sense here, at least in the translation. You've made him but a little lower than angels. But either way, the point being that God is this man, rather man, is this majestic being, that we are more than just hairless apes who figured out how to make iPhones. We are divine. We carry a divine spark within us, and that Elohim also sometimes means messengers. That's the meaning in which angels, it means angels, because angels, malachim also are the sense of their emissaries, or they're on a mission from God to do something, without getting into exactly what angels are. Excuse me. So Homoreligiosis lives with this tension. Part beast, part divine. And it tears them apart. Homoreligiosis has yet to find the third harmonizing verse. However, Halachic Man has found the verse, the Ketuv HaShlishi, the way to square this circle. The Halacha. What resolves the tension within man, within humanity? Halacha. He too, halachic man, also suffers from this dualism, from this deep spiritual split. But he mends the split through the concept of halacha and law. It's not that halachic man looks at homoreligiosis and can't relate and doesn't understand the experience. Halachic man also feels the dualism. He has just found a way to bridge it. And now we start talking about Yom Kippur. Halachic man also stands on the Day of Atonement as the sun is setting, as the great and holy day sinks into the fiery sea of glory and eternity, and the climactic Ne'ilah prayer confesses his sins before his creators. And the choice of Yom Kippur as the kind of demonstration of this, of these ideas, is significant, because Yom Kippur really is a day where we feel ma enosh, who are we? I'm going to try to summarize, because we have to make up for some lost time, but he quotes here different stitches from the Yom Kippur davening. Part of the whole liturgy of the litany of sin really is to say, I'm a garnished, I'm a nothing, I'm undeserving. And we beg to be allowed to come back in tshuva. And that's the theme of so many of the piyutim, particularly those surrounding the confession and the vidui on Yom Kippur, that we need God to open the doors for us. Because on our own, we're incapable. We can't get through the gate unless he pulls us along. Ma enosh. Motar ha'adam min ha'behema ayin. We are no better than a mute beast. But on the other hand, if that were the case, what would be the whole point of Yom Kippur? What would you need a Yom Kippur for? The beasts of the field do not need to do tshuva, because the beasts of the field do not sin. Tyrannosaurus Rex does not need to clap al chait that he ate the Triceratops. The cheetah does not need to ask the forgiveness of the gazelle, because that's what the cheetah is supposed to be doing. But when we rob, steal, sin, lust, when we defame and act arrogantly and we sin against man, and we sin against God, and we sin against ourselves, we are doing something wrong. So since there is Yom Kippur, that's the proof that we're better than the animals, that we're better than our animal selves. Because if in fact all we really were, if it really were completely true, notar ha'adam min ha'behema ayin, that the value added of humanity above animals is nothing, then we wouldn't need Yom Kippur. Because when we act the way we act, we would just be following our programming. And if, in fact, all we were doing was following our programming, by definition, it couldn't be sinful. Because that's who we are. That's how God made us. The value added of being human is that we need not only follow that programming, because we have a different operating system. I'm mixing a few metaphors here, but I hope you're following and understand the point that I'm making. We also have the operating system of the angel within. And it's that gap, the tension between the two, that is the source of sin. And that's what we're trying to overcome through Yom Kippur. So the very existence of Yom Kippur, with its halachic, and here, this is the way in which the halacha is the katuv hashlishi, is the resolving verse, is the secret to transcending the tension that's so central to the experience and life of homo religiosus, is the halachic system of Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur Shel Pam in the Beit HaMikdash with the Korbanot and the Se'er La'Azazel and the Kohen Gadol and the whole mechanism of the national kapara and the individual kapara. But even Yom Kippur in the way that we have it today, Yom Kippur about which Rabbi Akiva so famously said, Ashrechem Yisrael, l'fnei mi atem mitarim mi mitaretzkem. Right, that we, like today in some ways, it's worse. We feel the loss of the Beit HaMikdash. We feel the loss of the Korbanot. We feel the loss of the Se'er La'Azazel and the Kohen Gadol going Lifnai V'Lifnim. And that's so much, so central to the Yom Kippur davening is the discussion of what we don't have. But on the other hand, we're at an advantage because in the absence of that, and from a complete let brera, from a complete lack of any other option, all we have is the direct petition to God. Before whom do we purify ourselves, and who purifies us? Straight between us and God. It's true, if you sinned against a fellow man, you have to make it right with them before you can turn to God. But the act of tshuva is us facing the Kadosh Baruch Hu in tshuva, saying we can be better than our animal selves. If man, I'm going to skip ahead. There's a discussion here on page 70. He returns to this point about Tzimtzum, which we talked at length a few weeks ago, but if that still interests you, look at the bottom of page 70, because it's another example of him reorienting the understanding of Tzimtzum. But here, on page 71, if man, when confronted by God, would revert to nothingness and naught, then the command, which is the very foundation of the halakha, would be incomprehensible. The mystics, he had said, and homo religiosus as personified by a mystical orientation, thinks that this dualism is, the tension between heaven and earth is unbridgeable, it's unresolvable, you can't shrink that gap. And they have this notion that were the two to come together, were they to be bridged, all would be tohu vavohu. All would be destroyed. The Rav says, halachic man does not see it that way. What is the encounter between heaven and earth? What is the encounter between God and man? Halacha, mitzvah, the idea that we are mitzuvim, that we are commanded beings. Again, different than the animals. If man, when confronted by God, would revert to nothingness and naught, then the command, the mitzvot, tzivui, which is the very foundation of the halacha, would be incomprehensible. If our encounter with God would be some kind of religious nuclear option, then the entire, at least the entire halachic system, would be incomprehensible. Because what is halacha? Halacha is the encounter. We encounter God as commanded beings, and we fulfill that potential through the execution of those commands. For certainly God would not make a mockery of his own Torah. The fact that God linked himself with man and prescribed for man laws, statutes, judgments, bears witness that God, may he be blessed, does not nullify and obliterate man's being. And while the setting sun on Yom Kippur is still shedding a brilliant light, halachic man continues his prayer. V'natata lanu bi'ahava et yom ha-kippurim hazeh keitz l'sikha u'machila al kol avonotenu l'man la'asot chukei ritzonecha b'lev ha-pshalim. That's the bracha of Yom Kippur, that God has given Yom Kippur as a gift of love, and it's the climax, it's the conclusion of God pardoning and forgiving us for all our sins. Why does he pardon us and forgive us? So that through pardon and forgiveness, we can cease from the oppression of our hands. We can stop doing the evil that we had previously done, and then return to God to perform with a whole heart the mitzvot. The purpose of tshuva is to allow us to return to being more proper, more effective, more engaged mitzvah doers. The Day of Atonement, which was given to us in love, the promise of pardon, forgiveness, obligation to repent, the existence of the statutes which God has willed, are the clearest and strongest testimony to man's importance, his central place in the world. The second verse contradicts the first. You have made him but little lower than the angels and has crowned him with glory and honor. The halacha serves as the third harmonizing verse. On one hand, we're animals. On the other hand, we're angels. How do you resolve that contradiction? Through the halacha. How do you go from being an animal to being an angel? By being mitzuveh, by being commanded. And then he quotes the beautiful passage from the end of the Davening and Kippur, the end of Ne'ilah. Before I was formed, I was of no worth. And now that I've been formed, it is as if I had not been formed. Right? Before I was created, I was nothing. Now that I've been created, I'm still like nothing because I've missed my potential. If I don't reach my potential, then taka, really, I am just a bug. But through tshuva, we hope that we can recapture our true essence. It were better for man not to have been created. And here's a quote from a very well-known Gemara in Eruvin, that the Chazal debated. What would be better? Is it better to be born? Is it better to be created? Or is it better never to have been created? Because after all, since everyone sins, since there's no one who gets it right 100% of the time. So having been born is something of an oppression, because we're destined to, at some point or another, mess up. But if you're never born, you know, if you never get up to bat, you never strike out. So Chazal debate this question. The Gemara says they debated it for a very long time. And the conclusion was that maybe it would have been better not to be created. But now that we have been created, either as individuals or as a species, so each person should examine his deeds. Each person should do tshuva. This is the authoritative halachic judgment of the sages. And it means that repentance harmonizes the two verses. Tshuva in general, Yom Kippur in specific, is the mechanism, or it's the best example of how the halacha works to do that transcendence. Remember that chart that we've been using. There you go. Right here we're talking about homo religiosus and halachic man. Homo religiosus feels this tension between the world of the spirit and the material world, and he has no way to resolve it. His only desire is to negate the material world in order to transcend to the spiritual world, but he knows that that's impossible. Because after all, we're trapped down here. So he's caught in this tension. Halachic man does not feel the tension because he's able to resolve. He does, he's aware of the tension, but he's able to resolve it through bringing heaven down to earth. And that mechanism is the whole agenda of the halacha, which resolves and clarifies the tension that's built in to the nature of humanity, which is a dual being, torn asunder, animals with the divine soul. And only the halakha can overcome that. Thank you for standing by at the beginning of tonight's session, a most unusual experience in the history of the Web Yeshiva. We should be broadcasting while under fire. I hope that will be the last time, and everyone should now go back to being glued to the news about what's happening here in Medinat Yisrael. We'll continue next week. Next week will be, for us here in Israel, it will be Motzei Shivasa B'Tammuz after the fast. Those of you that are to our west may or may not still be fasting, depending upon where you are, but we will be having class next week. Laila Tov. Mm-hmm.